And this one is from 1967, April 28, 67. Al Ferrara hit a home run and had an infield single. Yeah, so enjoy those. You two gentlemen actually have a lot in common. You were both born in Brooklyn in 1939. Both you were teammates on the Dodgers championship teams. You both subsequently played for last place expansion teams. You both lost a year to an ankle injury. My first question, Bo, why don't you take this? Growing up in Brooklyn, talk a little bit about that and when you learned that the Dodgers were moving west.
Well, mine is an interesting story. I was a Brooklyn boy, born and raised there, and I was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. I can remember Jackie Robinson playing and breaking the color line, Don Newcomb pitching both ends of a doubleheader, Red Barber saying on the radio, "I've got a new announcer here, our third announcer, his name is Vince Scully." Robin Roberts completing a game, 304 of them, which he did in his career. So as a child in Brooklyn, I was reared up with sports. But the real thing about Brooklyn with me is the Sandlots of Brooklyn. The Sandlots of Brooklyn at that time developed many, many outstanding players. It was highly competitive. And from these Sandlots, okay, came major leaguers such as Joe Pignatano, Joe Pignatano, Mike Napoli, Fred Wilpon, who owns the Mets, also came out of that, Bobby G. Lombardo. But they weren't the talk of the Sandlots.
Bobby Estimone.
Right. There were five guys who stood out in those Sandlots. Five guys that people from all over came to watch see. All went on to have distinguished careers in the major leagues. They were Sandy Koufax, Joe Torre, the two-time National League batting champion, and one of the five best right-hand hitters I ever saw, Tommy Davis. Two-time All-Star in both leagues, Joe Pepitone and Bob Aspromonte. These guys stood head and shoulder. They were wonderful, wonderful players. And through the years, they went on to become great players and all-stars in the major leagues because of their great, great talent, not only their talent, but their perseverance. Then there was the sixth guy. Now, the sixth guy, nobody came to see him play. In his senior year in high school, he batted eighth on his high school team. His batting average was .083, four hits in 48 time at bats. That was me. I also made the major leagues. So in talking to a grassroots organization like yourself, you can see here what happens. You can have the great talent that becomes great players, and you can have the guy that wasn't supposed to make it that made it. One thing I'd like to share with you today, this all led on to, again, being a member of the 63 champions, the 65, and the 66 champions, of which I'm very, very proud of, okay, of being accomplishing that. And of course, in 67, I was the Dodger of the Year. But what gets me is when I told this to Paul Hirsch, who did my biography for Sabre, he stopped me there. And he said, "How could this happen? How could this be?" Okay, my answer was real simple. I don't know. Until a month ago, and I'm going to share this with you today. Okay, I was playing in a golf tournament with Jimmy Campanis, whose father was Al Campanis, the Dodger general manager. Prior to that, Al was the director of scouting for the Dodgers in the years that I was a child in Brooklyn. And here's the first scouting report through the eyes of a man who knows, okay? Jimmy Gage was so nice to give it to me, and I'd like to share this with you today. An 083 hitter, remember that. Catch this one right off the bat. Hot, hot. Prospect? Oh, 83? Come on, guys, let's go. Now I'm going to spare you with all the numbers that are written here. Definite prospect doesn't say nothing next to that. But it says, has chance? Yes. Follow? Yes. Tall, strong, active, has good actions. His arm and running speed will be good enough. I love the next one. He needs help with his hitting. Come on, Al. Come on, 83. He showed good power. I think he is a prospect that should be signed. We want him for the rookie club. Signed Al Campanis, 6'7", 1958. On top of it, it says, signed. Now, how one man can vision this. Now, remember, it has to be one man or one organization at that time. Because at that time, there was no draft. In other words, anybody could sign it. So they all came, you had 5-6 different offers. One offer, the Dodgers. So one man and one organization's vision went for a wonderful life with me. And now I'll turn it over to Tommy.
Is this on? Doesn't have to be, I guess. Huh? No. Koufax, Fred Wilmont, they went to the same high school. Do you know who was the best pitcher in the city at that time? You think it was Koufax? Fred Wilmont was the best pitcher in the city. Seriously. That's how good he was. It was like a man playing with kids. That's how good he could pitch. Alright? And he didn't sign it. I don't know why. I have no idea.
Because he wasn't by the Mets.
But at that time, I can remember only one other guy signing that at that time. His name was Jerry Boxer. Anybody remember that name? And he went to the Phillies at that particular year. That's the only two guys I remember, Fred Wilmont and Jerry Boxer. And but I also was very fortunate to come up and I played with an organization called the Brooklyn Bisons. And it was run by the only black manager or organization or organizer in the city at that time. You're talking in the 50s now. And we had three teams, junior, intermediate, and seniors, all right? And he taught us the game. His name was Clarence Irvin, and he's still living. He's about 87 years old now. And we all get together. The whole group gets together periodically. But we used to have meetings in the wintertime, and he gave us homework on baseball. Seriously, he gave us homework on baseball. And it really helped. But when I went to the minor leagues, it helped me a lot. In reference to hitting cutoff man and throwing to the right bases and everything. It really, really helped me get there quicker. But the good thing about this particular team, we were the 1955 New York State senior champs of the Kiwanis League, and we played our championship game in Cooperstown. I'll never forget that.
Tommy, you did have multiple offers, and you got an interesting call from somebody on the Dodgers to convince you to come here.
Yeah, I was in high school, and I had about four or five offers, Cincinnati, Phillies, Yankees, and Cleveland was the first to come approach me, and the Dodgers. And it came down to the Yankees. Why? Because in those days, there was no draft, and the most you could make was $4,000 to give you. If you got anything over $4,000, you would have to go to the major leagues for 2 years. Did you know that? Right? So that's a deterrent. That's what I'm all worth less. But I remember guys got money under their table, and they didn't say that. I know Bobby got some money under the table, and I did. We signed the same year. But the Yankees did was, to make it interesting, was I could work out at Yankee Stadium anytime I wanted to. Here's a 17-year-old guy working out with the likes of Mickey Mantle and Yogi Berra, Nelson Howard, and Moose Carroll, who I love, at any time I want, when they were home. Whoever heard of that? I hit with the pitches and went out and shagged when the big boys were hitting. Now, what the heck, you know, I figured, well, they're showing me a lot of attention, so I better sign with the Yankees. But Al Campanis would come to the house periodically to tell my family that they were still interested in me, like, you know, want you to know they were interested in what might like to sign them. Well, my father says, that's great, you know, for the Yankees, you know. And he says, I'm supposed to sign with the Yankees on a Tuesday night. Al had Jackie Robinson call me that Sunday before that Tuesday. Now, I wanted to sign with the Yankees in the first place because of Jackie Robinson. So when I heard that voice, first I thought somebody was kidding. I thought one of my friends was trying to get on my case. And I started saying, oh, who the hell is this? That's the first thing I said. And then he said, I'm Jackie Robinson. Then you got to think about it because he had sort of a high-pitched voice. Remember? The voice is kind of high. And I said, this is Jackie Robinson. I said, hey, Mom, this really is Jackie Robinson. She said, well, you better talk to him. And by the fact that he called me, and I was supposed to sign on Tuesday night, I signed Tuesday afternoon with the Dodgers.
Paul, you were a classic pianist, and you played in Carnegie Hall.
That's the truth, too. He plays Carnegie Hall, and he's a big old hand.
A lot of guys used to say, I didn't play, I picked up the piano and moved him into Carnegie Hall. But I did play, and the story behind that was real simple. My grandmother, who brought me up, came from Italy and came over with her best friend, whose husband was a piano player, and his and her teacher in Italy. When he came over, they taught my mother, the first generation, and then I was the first generation from mine, so they taught me. And he would have a concert each year in Carnegie Hall, and he would play, his best students would play. Well, of course, this was all classical. I could not play what the kids in the block wanted, Rock Around the Clock, or something like that. They didn't want to hear Bach and Beethoven that I could play. I could play Bach and Beethoven the way Bach and Beethoven wrote it on the music, but I could not play Happy Birthday by ear. So I was in a lot of trouble in that home, but I wanted to make Grandma happy. So being a Brooklyn kid, I had to figure out a way to make this work in my favor. So what I did was I would practice hard and I'd memorize everything, and Grandma would come to me afterward and say, that was so beautiful, that was so beautiful. And I say, wasn't it, Grandma? Could I have 50 cents more to go to batting cage? That's how I would get my extra money and go take hitting practice at the bat away in Coney Island. I conned Grandma. So, the story came down to the end. I wanted to play, and I wanted to play practice all the time and play baseball. And I said, Grandma, when I become, okay, because there was 10 students each year that would play, when I would become the number one student, I want to just concentrate on baseball. She said in her Italian accent, if you become the number one student, you become the player. So when I was 12 years old, I was number 10. And I progressed and I progressed. At 16 years old, I became the number one student. I walked off the stage, she came and hugged me, and I have never touched the piano again.
I wanted to elaborate on this team I was talking about. I told you it was a black manager, you know, organizer. He was the organizer. But the team was not all black, you know. It was an international team, you know. Our first baseman was named Pepe, Italian. Our second baseman was named McAllister and Mosley. They were a shortstop, second baseman. They were black. Ray Epstein is playing third. I'm in left. A guy who should be and should have been in the majors, his name was Walter Edge. He was outstanding, but his mother made him go to college. And he was in center. And Mario Panunzio was in right. I can remember all these names, right? Gil Barella was also played the outfield and pitch. Gil Pacetti, who was a Dodger scout and a Giant scout for about 40 years, has passed about, I think he passed last year. He was our pitcher. And Nick Catalano was our catcher. We had another guy in building, Richie Witt, and that was the group that won that championship that year. I'll never forget that.
I was wondering, Tommy, you went from the Dodgers championship team to the New York Mets in '67, the last place team. Boy, you made a similar transition when you were part of the expansion draft of the Padres. How does the mindset go when you go from a championship team to the cellar?
Well, you got to remember one thing. The first thing I ever remember from going from the Dodgers to the Padres was my first day in spring training. And I worked out real hard, and I'm going to give it, as I always did, 100% as best as I could, play as hard as I could. And I finished my first workout. And I went into the locker room, and I took my shower. Now, remember, it's Yuma, Arizona. There's no, like, we're an expansion team. They got no air conditioning in the clubhouse. It's, sweat is pouring up. So I finished the shower, and I asked for another towel, and I was declined. One towel. Right away, I knew this was going to be entirely different than what I experienced in L.A. One towel. Then, hey, look, I'll be honest with you guys, I'm a horse player. I like to play to horses, okay? That was my one of my passions and still was. When I played for the Dodgers, of course, a horse player, we get busted every once in a while. We need an advance. And I would go up to the Dodgers, and they would give me my advance to go play. When I went to the Padres, the same guy, Buzzy Bavese, who was the GM, was now part owner of the Padres. We ain't got no money, okay? We ain't got no money for advances, but I'll tell you what. The owner, the real owner of this team, he's a great guy, and I want you to go to his bank. He owned a bank. He'll give you a loan. Now, I went to the bank, and I got a loan. He charged me 19% interest. That's not over. This good guy wound up doing 5 to 10 years for fraud. Those are the Padre days, but I think one thing about from going from a great team like the Dodgers, the wonderful, wonderful players that we had to an expansion team. They're great guys too on the expansion team, don't get me wrong. But you become a trivia answer. You don't talk about championship. You are a trivia answer. And the triple universal grand slam of Padre history, Alvarado. Wow, okay, I'm a trivia answer. When Tom Seaver struck out 19 men in a game, 19 men in a game, 10 in a row to end the game. You guys are statisticians. You know if he strikes out 10 in a row, one guy's got to stop it, and one guy's got to end it, right? The first and the 10th, Alvarado. It's a trivia question.
Well, this started early, you know. I'm going along, swinging the bat, good and everything, and then I had a problem in 1964 trying to go for the third batting championship. First, I lose my greatest friend in the world, my high school basketball coach. His name was Mickey Fisher at Boys High. And he played, 54 sets of 10, some ridiculous thing, and he was like 54 years old. And then I lose my father. And then I lose my mother-in-law all in 1 year. Wow. And so I put a lot of pressure on myself and I didn't do it. And then the next year, I started to get my that was getting better, was coming back, and then I break an ankle May 1st, 1965. All right, and Dr. Curley, and it was a bad break, you know. It went all the way around like that, but you know, foot got caught in that Georgia clay we used to have in the infield. And so Dr. Curley said, "It's not that good. You need at least 2 years to come back, you know." But they traded me after 1 year. They traded me to the Mets. What are you gonna do? You know, I was a little disturbed, and I thought I gave them enough of my time that I warranted at least 2 years, you know. But what are you going to do? You can't do nothing about that. So I went to the Mets, which was great because that was my hometown. I figured, well, I could end my career in my hometown. And the manager was Wes Western. And I asked Wes, I'd like to play as much as I can without hurting your team. Well, it was a young team, and we were last place most of the year. That was the first year of Tom Seavers and Kuzman, and you had Cleon Jones and Harrison, Crane Poole, Sepulveda, had all those guys. But, he allowed me to play. Now, you know about the 2 years I had with the Dodgers. you know, led the league in ribbies and still have the record for Brooklyn and LA. But I'm saying this was the best year I've had in my life. This was the greatest year of my life when I was at the Mets, all right? He allowed me to play. I got up over 500 times. And got about 16 home runs, not close to 80 runs better than. And so I figured, well, I got a shot. Did pretty good. I thought it was really pretty good. I was going to be there, right? Well, I contributed to the World Series team. They won, what, 69?
69.
Well, I contributed to that because they traded me. When Gil Hodges, he needed a center fielder, so I had to go to the White Sox and Tommy Agee came to the Mets. So I contributed to the World Series. Right. But let me tell you how I hit 302, you know, with the last place club. It's really great. Next to the last day of the season of playing, the Dodgers at Dodger Stadium. I'm 0 for 2, and the count is 0 and 2, the third time at bat. And guess who's pitching? Drysdale. So I get out the box, and I said, Johnny, talking about Johnny Roseboro. He said, what's the matter? I said, Johnny, look up there, I'm hitting 299 or 300, I'm not sure. And I'm 0 and 2, and the count is 0 and 2. He said, I didn't know that, what you want? I said, give me something I can handle, man. Now, Drysdale's out there. And normally when it's 0-2, you don't get nothing good. You get something like right here. But I can, to this day, I got a ball right there. I hit a double. I got the second base in timeout. Get me out of here, because it's the next to the last game of the season, right? I left the game at 3-0-2.
Also did some acting, sharing time on the screen with Tallulah Bankhead and Zsa Zsa Gabor. What was that like?
As you can see, gentlemen, baseball, piano, acting shows you can screw up more than one career. Because I was a baseball player, okay, I got acting jobs, okay. One of the big producers in Hollywood was a Dodger fan at that time. There's 52,000 people out there every night. You had producers, actors, a regular fan. And this guy was there every night in a dugout seat, and he took a liking to me. He also was the producer of Batman. He was also the producer of Beretta. Now, these shows that I played in, TV shows, I call them brilliant plots. Gilligan's Island. Where you got shipwrecked, and you took a coconut and made a clock out of it. I also play an African, Tommy. And I swear this is the truth. Nobody believes this story, but I played an African. Of course, I was a native, so they got me all dug up, and I was nice and black and everything like that with my headdress on and all of this. And when it was over, I had a date that night. And I couldn't get this stuff off. So I went on a date, which led to the movie, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? Well, my acting career was that, and with Tallulah Bankhead, and of course Bobby Blake with Beretta, which was another great plot, a detective walking around town with a cockatoo on his shoulder. So, I mean, these are all, and some of my movie credits, Dracula's Dog. Okay, I did not play the dog, gentlemen. Mansion of the Doomed. And the great classic Riot on Sunset Strip. So when, unfortunately, this producer had an accident and passed away, ended my acting career.
Tom, you played for several different managers. How would you compare Walt Alston with Earl Weaver?
Walt Alston's very quiet. And he didn't have to, he didn't demand respect. He just had it because he was that way. I mean, number one, he had an experienced team. He you know, and you really didn't have to do anything. We did it ourselves. There was a problem. We solved it ourselves.
Exactly.
Right? And, but if it went overboard and we couldn't solve it ourselves, he could solve it. I remember one time in Pittsburgh, and he stopped the bus.
Yeah, great.
He stopped the bus. You know, we were complaining, but the bus is real slow. It had a governor on it.
And there was no air conditioning,
and it's a long ride. And, you know, we were complaining and stuff. And, you know, we had Big Frank Howard on this thing, too, you know. And so Walter got a little disturbed and said, to stop the bus, and said, listen, you got to complain. Come on outside with me right now. Just come on outside right now. Now, the damn person got up. Even Frank Howard. You know. But he didn't have to. He just had a good team. Now, Earl Weaver was a little different. Earl was funny. You know, he's real short, you know. Do you remember those in the old days? What was those shoes that had the long heels on? What do they call them?
Elevator shoes?
Well, you know,
platform.
Right,
okay.
Now, he came into the clubhouse when they were the platform shoes on. And they had the biggest heels he could find, you know. And when he came in and he stood, he was leaning this way. He was straight up. He's leaning this way. We call him Leaning Power. What? Pizza? What they call that thing? Yeah, we call him Leaning Power. But he won. He won. He liked to argue a lot. He's superstitious to me. One night, I think we were in Cleveland, and Paul Blair was in between marriages, and so he had a date, and I guess he must have come in late that night, and he was at the Holiday House, but he comes into the garage, and there's a big standard there, and coming in the same time was Earl Weaver, Van Berger, and Hunter, his coaches, and he kind of hid behind the standard there, and so, you know, they went upstairs, and then he proceeds to go upstairs, and next day he goes to the clubhouse, and Earl says, come here. Paul, come here. He said, what is this kid? He says, you didn't think I saw you last night, did you? Yeah. I did see you last night. And the fact that you're one of the best center fielders in baseball today, you wouldn't be playing. But I have to use you. But if you mess up tonight, I'm fining you $1,000. You better play well. So that night they're playing Cleveland, and Gaylord's pitching. Paul proceeds to get three hits and a game-winning home run, right? So after the game, Earl, come here, come on. He said, what is it now, Skip? He said, you are going to be at the same place at the same time. That was Earl. One time, I'm designated hitter. And I'm in the clubhouse, in the trainer's room, talking to my wife. And I'm talking, and I'm in the game, you know, I'm talking. And Ralph Salvo, the trainer, comes up, and he taps me on the shoulder and says, so what is it? What is it, Ralph? He said, you're up. I'm up. I should be in the batter's box right now. And I've got it. Oh, I'm up. Oh, okay. So I had to go to the clubhouse, through the tunnel. And Earl's at the end of the tunnel because he's smoking all the time. And he's watching me go through like this. And the people are starting to applaud when I come out the tunnel. It's been about 10 minutes before I got up. So, man, I'm first and second. And you know I got me a little single, not going to run, right? Right? So I go to the dugout. And I'll go past Earl. He wouldn't look at me because I got a base hit, right? He turned his head. I go all the way back up to the clubhouse, to the trainer's room. The phone is still open, my wife is still on the phone. Continue our conversation.
Paul, you played for Alston and Preston Gomez, Danny Ozark. How would you compare those guys?
First of all, Alston didn't know my name. Yeah, you pitch it. Walter was, again, like Tommy said, a type of guy who didn't say too much. At a veteran club, we went out there and we just did the job. We had, by the way, let me just expand on that team a little bit and talk to you. You guys are baseball people. You're wonderful, wonderful baseball people. I don't think that those teams of us for the won the 63, 65, and 66 pennants and two world championships get enough credit for how good we are. If we would have done this in today's era, we would be a dynasty. You don't hear too much about us anymore. You know, there was Dodger baseball before Tommy Lasorda. And that was our team, and we were a fine club. Austin ran the team. Hey, Austin didn't lose any games. Why? He gave the ball to Sandy. He gave the ball to Don. We'd get our Tommy to knock in a run. There's your one run. Go get him. And that's how we won games. As far as San Diego, Preston Gomez was a fine man, just didn't have nothing to work with. There was absolutely nothing there. We could hit. We had some good hitters in the lineup. But we were down 13-4 in the third inning, so there wasn't much to money. And Danny was just a wonderful, wonderful guy. Played for him in the minor leagues and while he was with a coach. Outstanding guy. All three of them I loved very much and got along with and had no problems with any one of them.
Very good. Well, we have a microphone here, so if you want to ask some questions, please line up. Go ahead, Norm.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say how great you guys are. Really, we follow the really great. Secondly, I just want to tell you very quickly, for 4 years in the 1980s, I lived in the city of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And one of my neighbors in the apartment building where I lived was Wes Covington.
Oh, that's what he
was. That's what he was. Left-hand hitter. Great hitter.
To this day, I don't know why he was there, but he was a neighbor of mine, and he showed me his 66 watch from the 66 pennant, so I'll never forget that. Anyway.
Sweet Daddy Covington, we called him Sweet Daddy.
Sweet Daddy.
He had a sweet swing.
I was a little young in those days, but I knew him historically, so. My question is, as Brooklynites, as young Brooklynites before you became professional ball players, what was your reaction to Jackie Robinson joining the Dodgers?
At the time that he did, I was 7 years old, so I really didn't get...
8 years old.
You guys are going to take it outside of it.
It's late, so I wasn't in December. I would have been 8. I went to the ball game, and the fans were crazy. And this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful player was playing. I didn't get the social event that was happening, the wonderful, wonderful thing that was happening. I didn't know about any of the color line or anything like that. I was a young man. As I grew older and watched him play and got the significance of it, what a magnificent player, a magnificent man. Brooklyn loved him. Okay, I don't care what anybody said. Brooklyn loved the people.
So did Montreal.
Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, when he came to Brooklyn, I mean, it was unbelievable, you know. And he was a great athlete in California, UCLA. And from what I gather, baseball was his weakest sport.
I read that, yeah.
Yeah, his weakest sport was baseball, right? And then when he came there, and the fact that, I guess in the late 40s or 50s, we had home TV. Did you guys remember that? All the TV games were on. All the home games were on TV. You guys didn't know that, did you? And not the Yankees, not the Giants, but just the Dodgers. So you got to see Jackie all the time. And the things he did just to beat you was outstanding. You know, just to steal a base. You know, just to get the pitcher rattled. You know, and under the circumstances and the prejudices and stuff like he went through, you know, it's just hard that he stood it. But I'll just give you a fact, you know, and he came in 47. And was 27 years old in 1953, and his hair was black.
Right.
In 1953, he came to my junior high school. What is that, 6 years later? His hair was totally white. Totally, in 6 years, his hair was white. But, you know, I mean, then reading about what he had to go through to get there, you know, he was special. He was, you know, he wasn't the best ball player in the Negro League on his team. Did you know that? I don't think he started. But he was picked out. The man upstairs picked him out. Branch Rickey picked him out. And that's history, right? It's all history now. And he died early, died of diabetes. He was 54 years old. There was some Newcomb had me crying. He says, right before he died, he was a great golfer. You guys didn't know that, did you? Jackie Robinson shot in the 70s. So right before he passed, Newcomb took him out because of the diabetes. You know, he's going blind, he's blind. And he got him on a golf tee, practice tee. And he said, I just want to hit the ball one more time. So Newcomb put the ball down in and showed him where it was and positioned him. And he hit the golf ball one more time.
Thank you both very much.
Tommy, you talked about going from the Dodgers to the Mets, but you really went from the penthouse to the outhouse when you joined the Seattle Pilots. Can you give us an impression of your time in Seattle?
Seattle, that was a strange team. That was a strange team. Gary, what's Gary, pitcher in Cleveland?
Gary Bell,
funny man. And as you know, Jim Bouton wrote his book. Who was the pitcher? Talbot. You remember Talbot?
Right.
Talbot. I'll give you a story. Evidently, and somebody knew that Fred he must have been married, but he had a girlfriend in New York. You know? And they had a paternity type of a thing, official too, written up, and had this cop that was outside the door all the time give it to him, you know. And I mean, I wouldn't have done this myself, but they did it to him, and he read this thing, and not all of us knew, most of us knew, and I've never seen a white man get whiter than white. You know, I mean, this guy was like, you know. And they didn't tell him for a day and a half. You know, he could have been home and tell his wife, hey, you know, I got something to tell you. But evidently didn't. And he kept looking at Bouton. I don't know why. You know, because he figured Bouton was did it. But it was another guy.
It was a catcher. Ray or
Renew, I think, did it. And for a day and a half, nobody said nothing to him. And he would go and look at this official document, and he'd look around at Bouton again, you know. And the guys were like biting him out, blood coming out, because they knew it wasn't true. That was our ball club. We had a guy named Gene Brombell. Remember Big Gene? Gene could make a blowgun. You know what I'm saying? A blowgun. And first it would start like, we come in and he'd have this, you know, this Western music on, his, you know, and I would change it and get some R&B, you know, some rock. And he'd change it back and look at me, you know. I said, you know, I wouldn't say anything. 6'4", I'd get, you know, I'm just saying. But one day he made this blowgun and he'd get hangers and make little dots, you know, put tape at the end and everything, and could redo it. He threw one at me and went right into my locker, right next to my ear. And I didn't know at the time. I said, who the hell? I turned around, it was Gene. I said, oh, well, Gene, can you not do that again, please?
Thank you. Hi, my question is for Al Ferrara. When you played that first season for San Diego, you had a third base coach, 35-year-old George Lee Anderson, who you ever later played for in Cincinnati. When he was your third base coach, could you have envisioned the success Sparky would have had in 25 years as a manager?
Sparky was all baseball. I mean, he was a great, wonderful guy. Okay, wonderful guy, but all baseball. I mean, Sparky would just live and die baseball. And yes, I could envision him going on to be a fine manager. I do have a story about Sparky for you. When I was with San Diego and I was finally at the end of the line, they traded me to Cincinnati when Sparky was the manager there. Sparky went after me. I saw how I played at San Diego. You know, did pretty well over there. And so, of course, this was just before the Big Red Machine became the Big Red Machine. So they were piecing it together. Sparky made a trade. And they traded me for an outfielder by the name of Angel Bravo. Now, Angel Bravo was hitting about 145. I think I was hitting 185 at that time. So it wasn't such a great trade, but it was a trade. Now, again, I just found this out this year, that Cincinnati threw in $25,000 because the Padres had to make payroll. So things aren't always bad like they are today. They were bad back then, too. So $25,000 plus Angel Bravo for me. So I went to Cincinnati. And, of course, Sparky wanted to see what he had. So he put me in left field in the first game. Well, like I said before, I was a little bit shot by that time. And the first ball came out, I destroyed it. I mean, it looked like a monkey jumping all around there, couldn't catch nothing. And so I messed up the ball, no run scored. But when I came back to the dugout, here I see Sparky standing on top of the dugout with his hands folded. Now remember, I'm just running in from left field. I haven't got too much time to think. I gotta figure something out. What am I gonna tell this guy? He's staring at me. And I looked him right in the eye and I said, what did you expect for Angel Bravo, Willie Mays?
I played with Sparky and Tommy Lasorda on the same team. You didn't know that, did you? I played with Sparky and Tommy in 1958 in Montreal. I came from Victoria, Texas, up to Montreal. Sparky was the second baseman. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have a question, but before that I have a comment about the great Jackie Robinson that I heard from Don Newcomb. And if you guys have heard it, forgive me, but the Dodgers were ahead 11-0, and Newcomb was pitching, and Jackie was playing second base, and Newcomb was dilling around. It was 11-0. Why worry? Jackie came into the mound and said, if you don't want to play hard, if you don't want to pitch and do a hell of a job, get the hell out of here. He said, that's the way Jackie Robinson was. He said, he didn't care what the score was. You give 110% all the time. And my question has to do with last year at our convention, Bobby Cox was there, and he was talking about Greg Maddux, and I know you guys prepare, and I know you're professional, but he said Greg Maddux, before a game, went through every hitter and every pitch and every inning that he was going to do. Fastball up, curveball, whatever, all of them. And about the eighth inning, he told Cox this. He told Cox what his plan was. And about the eighth inning, Cox came out for some reason or other, and Maddux said, don't you remember? I told you I was going to pitch this guy on third pitch. I was going to pitch a slow curve. Don't you remember that, you know? And Bobby was kind of, oh, yeah, I should have remembered that, you know. But anyway, I know you guys are professional. Whoa. Sorry. Stan Musial, they tell me, knew the speed of every pitcher's fastball and the speed of every pitcher's curveball in the league. Now, I never got a chance to ask a hitter how you guys prepared for the pitchers in the league. Did you know all of them? Did you keep a book? What did you do? Al, would you go first?
I would. I never kept a book. I knew how they were going to pitch me. I had come into the league as a high ball hitter, and then when I saw that we were in a low ball league, I decided I better change or I'm not going to be around here very long. So I adjusted myself to being a low ball hitter in spring training with a lot of practice. But I would remember when a pitcher pitched. I also would, at times, later on in my career, set up pitchers later in the game. I'll give you for instance, Don Sutton. I couldn't hit his curveball. I could not hit his curveball. I mean, he would just throw his curveball and I was out. But I knew somewhere down the line, these pitchers become Thomas Edison. They become experimenters. And I knew somewhere down the line I was going to get this fastball. And I eventually would get it off of him or anybody else. Now, when you get that pitch, you better hit it. Because you're not going to get it too many times. So I was more of a zone hitter that relied to hit to my strength. I wasn't going to play. If I knew a pitcher, Phil Negro, for example, I think I hit 600 off of Phil Negro. And I don't think I got one hit off his knuckleball. Because at 2-0 and 3-1, he'd throw you a lollipop fastball. So I knew I wasn't, if the Euchre who was catching couldn't catch his knuckleball, how was I going to hit it? So I would lay off of the pitch 2-0. Now if he threw it for strikes, then I was in trouble. So I was basically playing to my strength against, instead of the pitcher worrying about what he was going to throw me. If he gave me my pitch, I was going to hit.
Did you talk to people when a new guy came into the league, say up from Double A or something, that you never saw before? Did you talk to anybody before the game and say, what's this guy throw and who knows about him and all that?
Yes, we did that. But I'll never, this is another time with San Diego. I was sitting there, at that time I wasn't playing this day, and a big right-hand pitcher got up in the bullpen. I mean, the guy was so huge in the bullpen, he was throwing BBs. And I mean, I said, who the heck is this guy? J.R. Richard. But you guys, they were throwing BBs. So yes, we did talk about it, but sometimes it doesn't help.
Well, if you want to talk about hitting, we'll be here the rest of the day. Seriously, the way I looked at it, after I got started, if I'm going to make any money, I realized this, I'm not going to make money off the guys that are having a good year. There's one or two guys, one guy's going to win 20, one might win 18 or 19. Well, the other three pitchers, I'm going to make the money off, because either they're 500 percentage type pitchers, they're good when they're ahead in the count or they're ahead in the game, see? So, a lot of these pitchers like to give you fastballs the first pitch, all right? So I become a Bible hitter. Thou shalt not pass, you know what I'm saying? So, I take advantage of that, you know, because I know they want to throw a fastball first pitch. If they don't, I'm in trouble. But then you want to know what type of pitch they're going to throw when you have two strikes. Because they can't remember 500 ball plays, but they remember what they threw you with two strikes. And I'm going to remember that, and I'm going to flatten out my stance and think about a single. I'm not going to strike out. So my thing was, I'll take 10% strikeouts overall to the amount of times I bet. That one year that I hit the 346, I got up 665 times. I struck out 65 times. So if you make contact 90% of the time, you're gonna hurt somebody. They're gonna think differently of it. They're gonna play defense differently on you because they know you're gonna make contact. So my thing was making contact. I was not a long ball hitter. I was a line drive hitter. And so I waited for the ball to go longer, and I could hit to all fields. In fact, I hit to right field when I was a kid. I couldn't pull the ball. I had to learn how to pull the ball. So my thing is making contact. And then most pitchers know that. They become afraid of you because they know you're going to make contact.
I'd just like to carry that one more and mention another guy.
Sure.
Who carried it to the ultimate extreme.
Yeah.
Pete Rose. Pete Rose would follow the box scores for weeks upon weeks to see, and he had a schedule. Well, I'm going to be playing Pittsburgh 3 weeks from now. That means that Bob Veal is going to pitch that day. Let's see, he walked six guys that day, so the guy was crazy at Cincinnati. I never saw anybody that would prepare himself three, four teams in advance and pitch. He knew who was going to pitch two homestands down the road. So he was prepared that way. He carried it to another extreme, and obviously it worked.
Well, that's why I was surprised. I'm not a professional or anything, but, and I know Maddox prepared, I know you guys prepared, but I never knew anybody spaced it out hitter by hitter, pitch by pitch for inning one to inning nine.
And I want to say one thing. When I was with Baltimore, I could do my own hit and run, and usually Paul Blaze in front of me, you know. And we're playing the Yankees one day. I did three hit and runs that night. I got all three of them. All right? Wait a minute. The second one, I gave Paul the hit and run, and he looked like me, like I was crazy. Because the count was 0-2. I did it with 0-2.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, if you feel good enough, you it doesn't make it different what pitch it is, what count it is. If you feel good about it, you can do it. So I loved that you used to do the hit and run.
You remember I used to do that a lot?
It was wonderful. The guy could do everything. Yeah. But this guy could, he was, like I said in my opening, and I meant that sincerely. And I watched a lot of, obviously I like right-hand hitters. I'm prejudiced towards right-hand hitters. He's one of the five best right-hand hitters I ever saw. In my era, it was Clemente, Mays, Aaron, Tommy Davis, and Dick Al. And those were the five.
Thank you. Thank you. This is for Tommy. Tommy, I want to talk about one of your home runs. Game 3 of the 62 playoffs. I was watching on a screen about that big when you hit it off Marichal.
Thank you. Say it again.
I pretty much thought that won the game, but the TV camera, just so you know, put it totally on Willie Mays, like he was going to catch the ball. That ball seemed to be in the air for 30 seconds, and I don't know if you can recall that and think.
Oh, that was a line drive.
Was it a line drive?
I didn't
watch it on a screen.
We went up 4-2.
That was 3-2, and then Will scored in the eighth.
Right, made it 4-2. I thought we were in. You know, it's just that the pitcher didn't hold. There's a story about it. I'm not mad at Stan Williams, but wait a minute. But Leona Rocher and Don Drysdale were in the dugout. I mean, Duke Snider and Don Drysdale were in the dugout. Duke says, "Go over and set them when you like the pitch. You know, you like the pitch. Go to the bullpen. We leave." So he goes over to Walter Olson, and Duke told me this, and said, "You know, I'm available. You know, if you want me to go to the bullpen." And Walter Olson said, "No, I need you for the first game of the World Series." Well, goddamn, I'll pitch the first game of the World Series. I don't care who pitches the first game. Let's win this game. I was told that he went to it twice, and he said no. That's the 3 minutes.
Thank you to both of you again for coming.
Andy, one moment, please. Tommy, could you tell us about your ring?
This one here?
Yes.
This is 81. This is 81. I was a minor league instructor. They gave me one. I do have one for 63 and 65. Why don't you ask me about that? they gave me one for the 81.
Okay. It's very nice.
Tommy, this is really a question about the kind of falling percentage of African-American players in the game today. When you were in high school, you were a tremendous basketball player as well.
Say it again.
You were an extremely good basketball player as well as a baseball player. And I'm just wondering, in this day and age, do you think you would have gone and played basketball rather than baseball, and how does that play into the whole situation that we're seeing?
I was 6'4", 6'5", yes.
Uh-huh.
No, I was a forward in high school. I had no outside shot, and I don't know if you knew this, but my teammate was Lenny Wilkins. I made all city. He didn't. But no, he I got him out for a half a year because he graduated in January. He didn't have a father, so he had to work a lot, And so we both were going to go to Providence. And I decided not to because I didn't have an outside shot, because I knew, if I couldn't play forward, and the guy's going to be 6'6 and 6'7, so I decided to play baseball. But if I was taller, I would have gone and played basketball, yes.
Thank you.
Tommy, I have a question. What did you think of the Pilots uniforms?
I wish I had one now. It'd be worth a lot of money, wouldn't it? I enjoyed it. It was a nice uniform, I thought. The Pilots, it was associated with the harbor people, the boats and everything. I thought it was outstanding. Pretty good,
Okay. And Al, a question for you. Ginger or Marianne?
Well, my buddy and contemporary from that day, Bo Polinski dated Ginger, so I guess I get Marianne.
You guys played for a last place team. What do you guys tell the Dodgers right now?
That's
the toughest question of the day.
You have another question? Oh, you want to answer that question first? No. Playing for a last place team, I played for a last place, two teams that lost 100 games. And to me, whether I'm in first place or last place or who owns the team or who doesn't own the team means nothing. okay? My job on the field is, and believe me, when you're facing Gibson, Marichal, and these kind of pitchers, I'm not worried about what position or where we are. I'm trying the best that I can to do it. I know that it does affect certain players, but it sure shouldn't. We're very blessed to have been able to play this game, and you should play the game 100% all the time. And I think you got two guys here. By the way, talking about broken ankles, okay? Did you know that the three left fielders from the Dodgers in a row broke their ankle? Tommy Davis, Lou Johnson, and myself. So a broken ankle syndrome is there at Dodger Stadium. However, again, it shouldn't matter where position you are. You have to play the game hard and worry about what's here on the field.
Yeah, that's true. That is totally true. But being a ball player, being a hitter, what disturbs me is that I don't know how many men they left on third and second, and with less than two outs. It has to be close to 100 and something. Am I right, gentlemen?
Yes.
That many? Well, 100 or 150.
Yeah.
You know, that should never happen to any team. How can I say this? You know, there's part of this game should be taught about situation hitting. Situation hitting is so important. You know, if you got a guy that can run, you wait for him to steal, then you get him over. You got a man second and third, less than two outs. The easiest fly ball to hit if you're right-handed is the one going the opposite way. How many times have you hit a foul ball to the right side and it always goes in the air? You guys think about this. A foul ball to the right side from a right-hand hitter usually goes in the air, unless it hits to the end of the bat and it goes in the air. A foul ball from a right-hand hitter to the left side always goes on the ground. You don't know that. You didn't notice that, did you? But if you hit a ball on the ground to the left side, your hand is turned over. Your hand rolls a little bit, and when you hit the ball, you hit it down here, and it goes this way. Now, if you hit the ball this way, going to opposite field, it goes up in the air. So if I'm up at bat, when I got men on, second and third, less than two, I'm going to try to hit a fly ball to right field. If not, it's going to go foul, right? If I can get that long enough, I'm going to get that one run. Or if they're playing me back, I'm going to hit ground ball to second base, if I have to push it over there, because I know this guy's going to score. I mean, that's something you should know yourself. Nobody should have to teach you that. You should not have, you know, somebody said they're hitting with men in scoring position? 134. That's ridiculous for anybody in the major leagues to be hitting 134 with men in scoring position with less than two outs. So, I mean, I know they're going to play their best, and you know, and they know the best. A lot of these kids are young, they're bringing them up now. But an experienced team would never let that happen. They know how to get runs in. If they have to bunt the ball over there, they'll get the run in. And I don't see that in this day and age.
Just to add to that, in the back to my teams of the 60s, which I think we don't have enough credit, we used to play against teams of the Braves, the Giants, Cardinals, the Pirates. They were loaded with all Hall of Famers. Yet we would win. Okay, why would we win? We had special drills before in batting practice. A man would take their swings, they'd get on first base. The hitter would bunt into second base. He would run to second. Then he had to hit a ground ball to second base to move him to third. Then he had to hit a fly ball to the outfield. And that's how you manufactured runs. Exactly what Tommy was saying. Situational hitting. That's how we beat those teams.
I'll give you a good example. Gibson. We're playing Gibson. Morin gets up. Now, Gibson didn't like me. You know, he tries to hit him in his leg. Not in the head, in the leg, because you want to, you know, stop him from running. But he either walked him trying to do that or he hit him. Morin was still second. Gillian would hit a ground ball at second base. He'd go to third. Willie Davis, they can't play him in because he flies. So he hits another ground ball to the shortstop or to second base. Morin scores. At the end of six innings, now, by the way, Gibson's pitching against Kovacs, all right? By the end of six innings, the score is 1-0, and Gibson is pitching a no-hitter. You hear me? That happened twice in 1 year.
Yes.
It happened twice in 1 year. We're winning 1-0, and he's pitching a no-hitter. Eventually, we got some hits, But this is how we manufactured runs. We knew what we had to do. We had speed. We didn't have many home run hitters. I hit a couple, but we had Frank Howard at the time, too, also. But we manufactured because we knew how to pitch. All we had to do was get one or two runs. I'm on first, Willie's on third. A fly ball, not a fly, a little ball behind second base where the first baseman and the second baseman go out, catch it. As soon as one of them catches, I go because there's nobody at first. I start running for a second, and they can throw me on easy, right? But they don't know Willie's on third, right? So they got to watch themselves because I keep going. The longer I keep going, he's going to have to throw it. Once he throws it, Willie's going to score. If you don't throw it, I go to second, standing up. So we manufactured runs. We did things nobody else did. What about just Willie Davis scoring on a sacrifice fly? Sounds normal, doesn't it? Just going on a sacrifice fly. But he was at second base. He was at second base. The ball hit deep in center field and Wrigley Field. He scored all the way from second base and a fly ball out. That's how we made runs. That's how we won.
I wish I could be transported to the 60s and watch you.
Come on, we're going to go back there. I'll teach you all about it.
You know, the Dodgers had had three shutouts, consecutive shutouts, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Dodger Stadium is a pitcher's park. Why does Ted Lilly have so much problems?
I can't answer that. I like him. I like him. He throws strikes. He might get him up a little bit.
Yes,
but,
he does.
But, you know, he gets it up a little bit and he gets hurt. But we're not scoring any runs. If we get one, two, or three runs, he has a good season. Now, I think, you know, the clutch, you know, we know, I know Kershaw is the best pitcher, the clutch pitcher. Do you know who I would like to play against? That Japanese pitcher, what's his name?
Corona.
I like him. He keeps you in the game.
Yes, he does.
He does. Unfortunately, nobody supports him. He don't get many runs. Yeah, once in a while he had a bad game two hours ago, but he's always in the game. I like the way he pitches. But don't forget, when they come over here, they're in their 30s.
Yeah,
for sure. They had to play at least 10 years in Japan before they come over here. But we got the pitching. We don't have the consistent hitting and run making.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, we have time for two more questions.
Thank you both for coming today. My earliest baseball memory is the 1971 season, and Tom, you were in Oakland. And I just loved Vida Blue that year. He was just unbelievable. And the rest of that team was just getting ready to win. And in 72, 73, 74, the A's won the championship.
You're trying to get on me, aren't you?
No, I'm just saying what was it like to, you know, play with Vida Blue that season? He was just so sensational.
He lived with me. He did. He lived with me. You know, I had a friend, Spider. You remember Spider?
Yeah.
Spider had a triplex. We lived in Oakland. Now, Vida was the belle of the ball, you know, and locally they want him to make appearances and stuff like that. I kind of helped him, all right? And now it gets to the point where he needs, it's getting bigger than life. I said, Vida, you need some legal representation, all right? Now, every place he goes, even on the road, there's 10, 15, 20, 30,000 extra people in the ballpark. He's making the money. So I said, I introduced him to my lawyer. His name was Bob Gersh. Remember, you probably remember that name, right? He did some work for me and Jerry West. All right? So what he did was, for the rest of the season, like three quarters of the season, did three endorsements. He made $71,000 in 1971. Now, He wants him to represent on contract time. And Finley is a tough man. Finley was a bad man, really was. Yeah. I mean, he was. I'm telling my story, but he was outstanding. But I'm playing golf tournament, and Gene Wall comes up to me and doing this stuff in November saying, why is Finley manager? Well, I don't know why he's mad at me, because that year I hit 326, I got up 200 times, I knocked in 42 runs, I had 9 game winning hits. Reggie Jackson had 9 game winning hits playing every day. So it kind of went over me. I wasn't thinking about the Laura thing. I'm saying, I'll be all right, you know. We're in spring training, and I'm hitting 500, 9 for 18. We go all the way from Mesa to Yuma, and gentleman who just passed a couple of days ago was the manager, Dick Williams. Right? He gets me all the way to Yuma, comes up to me, I got to talk to you a little bit. He says, what is it, Dick? He says, I got to release you. Are you kidding me? You know, no, seriously, I got to release you. I never heard of anybody getting released in 300, have you? They released me because I introduced them by the blue to the Lord. All right. I got bored of that story, but I'm not going to get into it. Vida Blue was outstanding, you know, and he was a very confident man. You know, he knew guys would ask silly questions that the sports reporters, and he was young, but he said, next question, please. I just add to that, things like that. I mean, he was just well beyond his years, you know, and he just had a little wrinkle slider. But the fastball, he could hit up and down, in and out. And he could hit the ball a little bit, too. He made everybody else good. But what I thought he was getting alluding to was the fact that we lose to Baltimore, right? In the playoffs. Then I go to Baltimore, and we lose twice to who? Oakland. So, you know, my whole life has been that way, you know? You know, can't get no respect.
Thank you very much.
Tommy, as a 12-year-old, remembering how I cried when the nightmare of the bottom of in the ninth inning in the 62 playoffs, game three, if you could describe briefly your range of emotions watching that ninth inning unfold, and also real quickly, who was faster on those great Dodger teams, Willie Davis or Maury Wills? Thank you.
There's no doubt in my mind Willie Davis was the fastest. You know, we had a race one time in Vero Beach. And Willie was in the minor leagues.
We didn't know about Willie.
Nobody.
Except for Buzzy. Your boys. No. Padres, yeah. Buzzy, Zimmer. Stan Williams.
Zimmer.
They knew about him. See, Willie ran a 9.400 in high school. 9.4. Not 100 meters, 100-yard dash.
Yeah.
We didn't know that. So we had a 60-yard dash. And they broke twice. Was it twice?
Yeah.
Me and Earl Robinson was the fourth guy. Earl Robinson. We were down like we were track stars or something. So, you know. And this guy, Hamilton.
Leon Hamilton.
Yeah, he dropped his handkerchief, and it was, you know, and they were running before he dropped the handkerchief. So about the third time, we looked at it and said, we better run. You know, they kind of broke again, but Willie ran a 6.260, and Moore and I were 6.25.
Wow.
Both of us. It was a blanket finish.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah.
And then the range of emotion when the 1960s.
I don't want to talk about that tonight. But I mean, it was one of those things. I remember Maury got a ball, and they had Larry Burrard was playing second, and they had pushed him way over.
Who moved Burrard? That was the
Leo LaRosa.
Yeah,
they moved him way over there, and Maury got a 3-4 hopper. He didn't know where to go and get over there and throw it or wait on Larry. And Larry had come way from middle, way out on second base, come there, jump up in the air because in order for him to throw to first, and just Harvey Keene just made it.
Just made it.
And that was one of the things. And Ed Roebuck gets a line drive, hit right his glove, and it was by Baze, and it dropped. Little things like, I don't want to remember this.
For years, that was a big thing around the Dodger clubhouse, and who moved Burrard? Because if he hadn't have moved, we might
have won. But had a double play.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.